please. The headlights were from vehicles belonging to two Marine units supported by Delta Force operators. The Marines greeted the OTS team in short-bedded Toyota pickups, woefully inadequate for hauling 5,000 pounds of equipment to the governor's palace in downtown Kandahar. Two trips would be necessary, the trip taking an hour each way. The palace compound had, until recently, been home to the Taliban's reclusive one-eyed spiritual leader, Mullah Omar. A chief architect of Taliban rule, Omar had issued the religious decrees that turned Afghanistan into a repressive regime that provided a sanctuary to Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorists. The complex consisted of two large parallel buildings, one the residence and the other the meeting hall auditorium, with a courtyard between them and narrow walls at each end to create an enclosed rectangle. The team once more transferred the gear, this time into the palace. The nearly three-day trip had left them exhausted, and sleep was a priority. However, not 4 hours later, Mark was awakened with urgent news. A man claiming to have important information had come into the courtyard, telling a story about explosives buried within the palace. Fighting grogginess and working through an interpreter, Mark engaged the slightly built man dressed in tunic and turban. Speaking in a calm, deliberate voice, the volunteer explained that the retreating Taliban hid explosives in the palace's earthen roof. The explosives, he said, were to be detonated just after sundown that day, at the start of the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, the three-day celebration marking the end of Ramadan. The walk-in seemed credible, so credible that Mark could not suppress the suspicion that he had helped plant the explosives and was now having second thoughts. With the fall of the Taliban, loyalties in the country were shifting daily. The volunteer, who spoke matter-of-factly about explosives, possibly only a few meters above their heads, would not have been the first Taliban loyalist to switch sides. Inside the palace, everything seemed normal, with the American and British troops and Afghanis all involved in their own tasks. More than 50 people were already present, preparing for the Eid festivities, and within hours, the assembly hall would be filled with the principal leaders of the southern third of Afghanistan, guests of the new governor, Gul Aga Sherzai, who was hosting the event. For experienced OTS officers, who had picked through many post-blast scenes, it was easy to imagine the sudden death and destruction from a rooftop blast. Destroying Afghanistan's southern leadership on a Muslim holy day would be a cruel, audacious act and a devastating blow to the new government and the United States. Delay could prove fatal to the local officials and guests, more than 100 U.S., Australian, and British military personnel, as well as America's Afghan policy. Within 15 minutes of the conversation, Mark made the decision to send one member of the team to the roof. Putting an officer on the roof in daylight was risky. If the building was under surveillance, anyone on the roof was certain to be spotted, and a terrorist could decide to detonate ahead of schedule. Mark calculated the risk, taking into account the approaching nightfall and the start of Eid. Both were less than 4 hours away. Frank Shumway, a tech experienced in using thermal imaging equipment, was rousted from a sound sleep. After Mark explained the situation, Frank agreed to climb onto the roof. Strapping on 100 pounds of equipment, including communications gear to keep him in constant contact with the team, Frank would report each movement and every observation. These transmissions would be recorded, and should a detonation occur, by accident or command, the recorded information could provide valuable data for post-blast investigators and future operations. After navigating the narrow ledge of the perimeter wall that joined the two buildings, Frank climbed a 10-foot ladder to reach the earthen roof above the palace's assembly hall. Its smooth and hard-packed surface showed no signs of recent disturbance, but as soon as he switched on the thermal imager, the results immediately contradicted everything Frank saw through his own eyes. The small screen identified four distinct hotspots, each giving a signature of recent excavation. What the human eye cannot see registered clearly on the screen. No matter how well a recently dug hole is refilled and disguised, it will absorb heat at a different rate than an undisturbed area. Foreign objects just below the surface, such as IEDs, can also enhance the thermal signature. Four holes are set in an L shape. One hole is positioned directly above the reception area, and the three others run along the lateral axis of the primary assembly hall, Frank reported. The imaging also shows a narrow line of disturbed earth from hole to hole, then off toward the edge of the building. Frank's information bolstered the credibility of the walk-in's report. Should the holes contain even a moderate amount of explosives, the blast would, at minimum, collapse the roof. While the imager could not provide clues to what, if anything, was beneath the surface, the pattern, size, and shape of the hotspots were consistent with what was known of how mines or munitions could be deployed. If the holes concealed an explosive array, the work had been extraordinarily well done. Satisfied that the roof had been thoroughly imaged and convinced that explosives were likely buried there, Mark recommended to the U.S. officer in command that military personnel and the Afghanistan locals preparing the celebration be ordered to the far side of the compound. The soldiers complied, but the Afghanis declined to evacuate or even suspend their preparations. It was only 2 hours before dark, and guests had already begun to arrive in the reception area. With the most experience in explosive ordnance disposal of any member of the team, Mark made the next foray onto the roof to probe the hotspots. Information from the walk-in, combined with the hole patterns and a narrow line of disturbed earth running from the holes to the edge of the roof, all strongly suggested the explosives were configured in a command-detonated array. With command detonation, the four connected charges would be set off with a single signal. Working with the command detonation hypothesis, the team prepared a small electric charge to cut the command wire. The potential for disaster was enormous. The team still had no idea what type of IEDs lay buried inches beneath the surface, whether there was a secondary detonation system, or if they were booby-trapped. As the reception hall rapidly filled with Afghan dignitaries and nightfall approached, Mark took the narrow staircase to the roof and began gently probing around the areas shown on the imager. Several inches underground, his probe hit what felt like steel. He carefully swept the crumbled earth away to expose a small section of the buried object. Using the thermal images as a roadmap, he continued working slowly and cautiously, and eventually identified an 8-gauge detonator lead wire buried just beneath the surface that connected the four holes and led off to join a tangle of other communications and electrical wires that fed the building from the outside. He had seen enough. There were several explosives beneath the roof linked for command detonation, with the signal wire trailing off to some remote place in the war-battered city beyond the compound. He attached the electrical cutting charge, gave the signal, and the line was severed. Mark left the roof just as the sun was setting. Afghan dignitaries were now crowded into the reception hall of the palace, oblivious to what was likely thousands of pounds of live explosives only a few feet above their heads. The end of Ramadan was announced as Mark made his way down the narrow staircase, and a liberated Kandahar erupted in celebratory gunfire. He could not suppress a smile at the thought that somewhere among the city's celebrants was a terrorist, his finger repeatedly pushing a button in vain, wondering why in the name of Allah his best efforts had come to naught. There had not been time to consider removing whatever munitions lay buried beneath the surface. The palace compound was as secure as possible, and Mark reasoned that leaving the munitions buried until the end of Eid carried little risk. After Eid, an Afghan military demining team was brought onto the compound to dig the ordnance out of the roof. Mark estimated that it would take 1 day per hotspot, 4 days in all, to safely excavate the explosives. With the Afghan squad assembled, two OTS team members began a 4-hour refresher course in Explosive Ordnance Disposal, EOD, procedures and safety. The introductory remarks were never concluded. The senior Afghan officer interrupted to announce that his troops were well prepared for this type of work. No further training was necessary. It was the shortest refresher course in OTS history. The OTS team watched at a distance as the Afghanis attacked the job with frightening enthusiasm. What Mark had estimated as a four-day job was finished in less than one. Before the day ended, the Afghanis had removed more than 2,200 pounds of hard-case explosives, including 55 122-millimeter tank rounds and more than 100 anti-tank mines from the four hotspots. A fifth hotspot turned out to be empty. The rooftop IED would be classified as rudimentary, but what it lacked in sophistication, it compensated for in size. Detonation would have reduced the palace to rubble, killing or injuring everyone inside, and in all likelihood taking out the U.S.-occupied structure across the courtyard. We've heard a dozen times from our paramilitary colleagues and the special ops guys that our entire deployment was paid for in full that first day, noted a team member. A few days later, with the components of the bomb piled up outside the palace as a photo op, the local commander called a press conference to announce the find and the successful defusing. A single bored reporter, along with a photographer, listened politely and took notes, but no story ever appeared. The walk-in was invited back to the palace to receive a reward. Afghan and U.S. personnel staged a semi-formal ceremony. After drinking his tea, he was given $1,000 in $100 bills. He showed little reaction to the reward money, which he accepted graciously, and then offered a short speech, declaring that his only motivation was to help his country. The OTS team remained in Afghanistan for another 6 weeks, clearing hundreds of tons of ordnance from homes and remote hideaways. While hiking the rugged White Mountain Range with Delta Force operators, they discovered caches of aging explosives crammed into the man-made caves. In one cave, stockpiles of mortars and mines were packed from floor to ceiling, extending far back into the mountains. A B-52 bombing strike was required to detonate the massive cache. On the outskirts of Kandahar, in the rubble of an Al-Qaeda training camp, the team discovered and then destroyed dozens of drums of chemicals used to produce the explosive known as triacetone triperoxide, or TATP. A favorite of suicide bombers, TATP was used by would-be shoe bomber Richard Reed in his foiled attempt to bring down an airplane in December 2001, and again by terrorists in the July 2005 London bombings. The number of lives they saved may never be known. Upon their return to the United States, members of the team were awarded the CIA's Intelligence Star for Valor in a ceremony presided over by DCI George Tenet. They became members of an elite cadre of some 20 techs whose courage and service has earned the honor of receiving the Intelligence Star during the 50-year history of the Office of Technical Service.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.